Chapter 27, The Path of Empire, 1890 to 1899. In the years immediately following the Civil War, Americans remained astonishingly indifferent to the outside world, enmeshed in struggles over Reconstruction, and absorbed in efforts to heal the wounds of war, build an industrial economy, make their cities habitable, and settle the sprawling West, most citizens took little interest in international affairs. But the sunset decades of the 19th century witnessed a momentous shift in U.S. foreign policy. America's new diplomacy reflected a far-reaching changes that were shaping agricultural, industry, and the social structure. American statesmen also responded to the intensifying scramble of several other nations for international advantage in the dawning of the Age of Empire. By the century's end, America itself would become an imperial power, an astonishing departure from venerable anti-colonial traditions. Imperialist stirrings. Many developments fed the nation's ambition for overseas expansion. Both farmers and factory owners began to look beyond American shores as agricultural and industrial production boomed. Many Americans believed that the United States had to expand or explode. The country was bursting with a new sense of power generated by the robust growth in population, wealth, and productive capacity, and it was trembling from the hammer blows of labor violence and agrarian unrest. Overseas markets might provide a safety valve to relieve those pressures, more people to sell to. Other forces also whetted the popular appetite for overseas involvement. The lurid Yellow Press of Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst described foreign exploits as manly adventures, the kind of dashing derring-do that was the stuff of young boys' dreams. Pious missionaries, inspired by books like the Reverend Hosiah Strong's Our Country, Its Possible Future, and Its Present Crisis, looked overseas for new souls to harvest. Strong trumpeted the superiority of the Anglo-Saxon civilization and summoned Americans to spread their religion and their values to the backward peoples. He cast his seed on fertile ground. At the same time, aggressive Americans like Theodore Roosevelt and Congressman Henry Cabot Lodge were interpreting Darwinism to mean that the earth belonged to the strong and the fit, that is, to Uncle Sam. This view strengthened as latecomers to the colonial scramble scooped up leavings from the banquet table of the early diners. Africa, previously unexplored and mysterious, was partitioned by Europeans in the 1880s in a pell-mell rush of colonial conquest. In the 1890s, Japan, Germany, and Russia all extorted concessions from the anemic Chinese Empire. If America was to survive in the competition of modern nation-states, perhaps it too would have to become an imperial power. The development of a new steel navy also focused attention overseas. Captain Alfred Thayer Mann's book of 1890, The Influence of Sea Power Upon History, 1660 to 1783, argued that control of the sea was the key to world dominance. Read by the English, Germans, and Japanese, as well as by his fellow Americans, Mann helped stimulate the naval race among great powers that gained momentum around the turn of the century. Red-blooded Americans joined in the demands for a mighty navy and for an American-built Isthmian canal between the Atlantic and the Pacific. That's like the Panama Canal, eventually. America's new international interest manifested itself in several ways. As Secretary of State, first in the Garfield administration and later in the Harrison administration, James G. Blaine pushed for his Big Sister policy. It aimed to rally the Latin American nations behind Uncle Sam's leadership and to open Latin American markets to Yankee traders. Blaine's efforts bore modest fruit in 1889 when he presided over the first Pan-American conference held in Washington, D.C. Although the frock-coated delegates did little more than sketch a vague plan for economic cooperation through reciprocal tariff reduction, they succeeded in blazing the way forward for a long and increasingly important series of international assemblages. Quick pause. Reciprocal tariff reduction means I'll lower our tariffs if you lower yours. It's kind of being kind to each other in trade. A number of diplomatic crises or near wars also marked the path of American diplomacy in the late 1880s and early 1890s. The American and German navies nearly came to blows in 1889 over the faraway Samoan Islands in the South Pacific. The lynching of 11 Italians in New Orleans in 1891 brought America and Italy to the brink of war. The crisis was diffused when the U.S. agreed to pay compensation. In the ugliest affair, American demands on Chile after the deaths of two American sailors in the port of Valparaiso in 1892 made hostilities between the two countries seem inevitable. The threat of attack by Chile's modern navy spread alarm on the Pacific coast until American power finally forced the Chileans to pay up an indemnity. A simmering argument between the United States and Canada over seal hunting near Pribilof Islands off the coast of Alaska was resolved by arbitration in 1893. The willingness of Americans to risk war over such distant and minor disputes demonstrated the aggressive new national mood. Monroe Doctrine's and the Monroe's Doctrine and the Venezuela Squall. America's anti-British feeling, which periodically came to a head, flared ominously in 1895 and 96 over Venezuela. For more than half a century, the jungle boundary between British Guyana and Venezuela had been in dispute. You can see the map to the right there. The Venezuelans, whose claim on the whole were extravagant, had repeatedly used and urged arbitration. But the prospect of a peaceful settlement faded when gold was discovered in the contested area. President Cleveland, a champion of righteousness and no lover of Britain, at length decided upon a strong protest. His no less pugnacious Secretary of State, Richard Olney, was authorized to present London a smashing note, which Cleveland later dubbed a 20-inch gun blast. Olney declared, in effect, that the British, by attempting to dominate Venezuela in this quarrel and acquire more territory, were flouting the Monroe Doctrine. London should therefore submit the dispute to arbitration. Not content to stop there, Olney haughtily informed the world's number one naval power that the United States was now calling the tune in the Western Hemisphere. This was actually trying to live up to the Monroe Doctrine, keep foreign powers out. British officials, unimpressed, took 4 months to prepare the reply. Preoccupied elsewhere, they were inclined to shrug off Olney's lengthy salvo as just another twist of a lion's tail designed to elicit cheers from Irish-American voters. When London's answer finally came, it flatly denied the relevance of the Monroe Doctrine, while no less emphatically spurring arbitration. In short, said John Bull, the British, the affair was none of Uncle Sam's business. President Cleveland, mad clear through, as he put it, sent a bristling special message to Congress. He urged an appropriation for a commission of experts who would run the line where it ought to be. Then he implied if the British would not accept this rightful boundary, the United States would fight for it. The entire country, irrespective of political party, was swept off its feet in an outburst of hysteria. War seemed inevitable, even though Britain had 32 warships of battleship class to only five of ours. Fortunately, sober and second thoughts prevailed on both sides of the Atlantic. The British, though vastly annoyed by their upstart cousins, had no real urge to fight. Canada was vulnerable to yet-to-be-raised American armies, and British's rich merchant marine were vulnerable to American commerce raiders. The European atmosphere was menacing for Britain's traditional policy of splendid isolation. The European atmosphere was menacing, for Britain's traditional policy of splendid isolation was bringing insecure isolation. Russia and France were unfriendly, and Germany, under the sable-rattling Kaiser Wilhelm II, was about to challenge British naval supremacy. The German Kaiser, blunderingly and unwittingly, increased chances of a peaceful solution to the Venezuelan crisis. An unauthorized British raiding party of 600 armed men was captured by the Dutch-descended Boers in South Africa, and Wilhelm forthwith cabled his congratulations to the victors. Overnight, British anger against America was largely deflected to Germany, and London consented to arbitrate the Venezuelan dispute. The final decision, ironically, awarded the British the bulk of what they had been claiming from the beginning. America had skated close to thin ice of terrible war, but the results on the whole were favorable. The prestige of the Monroe Doctrine was immensely enhanced. Europe was irked by Cleveland's claim to domination in this hemisphere, but he had made his claim stick. Many Latin American republics were pleased by the determination of the United States to protect them, and when Cleveland died in 1908, some of them lowered their flags to half-mast. The chastened British, their eyes fully open to the European peril, were now determined to cultivate Yankee friendship. The British inaugurated an era of patting the eagle's head, which replaced a century or so of America's twisting the lion's tail. Sometimes called the Great Rapprochement or Reconciliation between the United States and Britain, the new Anglo-American cordiality became a cornerstone of both nations' foreign policies as the 20th century opened. Spurning the Hawaiian Pear. Enchanted Hawaii had early attracted the attention of Americans. In the morning years of the 19th century, the breeze-brushed islands were a way station and provisioning point for Yankee shippers, sailors, and whalers. In 1820 came the first New England missionaries, who preached the twin blessings of Protestant Christianity and protective calico. They came to do good, and did well. Their children did even better. In some respects, Honolulu took on the earmarks of a typical New England town. Americans gradually came to regard the Hawaiian Islands as a virtual extension of their own coastline. The State Department, beginning in the 1840s, sternly warned other powers to keep their grasping hands off. America's grip was further tightened in 1875 by a commercial reciprocity agreement, and in 1887 by a treaty with the native government guaranteeing priceless Navy base rights at spacious Pearl Harbor. But trouble, both economic and political, was brewing in the insular paradise. Sugar cultivation, which had become immensely profitable, went somewhat sour in 1890 when the McKinley Tariff raised barriers against the Hawaiian product. white planters, mostly Americans, quickly concluded that the best way to overcome the tariff was to annex Hawaii to the United States. But that ambition was blocked by the strong-willed Queen Lililukaiani, who insisted that native Hawaiians should control the islands. Desperate whites, though only a tiny fraction, a tiny minority, organized a successful revolt in early 1893. It was openly assisted by American troops who landed under the unauthorized orders of the expansionist American minister in Honolulu. "The Hawaiian pear is now fully ripe," he wrote exultantly to its superiors in Washington, "and this is the golden hour for the United States to pluck it." Hawaii, like Texas of earlier years, seemed ready for annexation, and at least in the eyes of the ruling American whites. An appropriate treaty was rushed to Washington, but before it could be railroaded through the Senate, Republican President Harrison's term expired and Democratic President Cleveland came in. Old Grover, who set great store by national honesty, suspected that his powerful nation had gravely wronged the deposed Queen Liliuokalani. Cleveland abruptly withdrew the treaty from the Senate early in 1893 and then sent a special investigator to Hawaii. The subsequent probe revealed the damning fact that a majority of the Hawaiian natives did not favor annexation at all. But white revolutionists were firmly in the saddle, and Cleveland could not unhorse them without using armed force, a step American public opinion would not have tolerated. Although Queen Liliuokalani could not be reinstated, the sugar-coated move for annexation had to be abandoned temporarily until 1898. The question of annexing Hawaii touched off the first full-fledged imperialistic debate in American experience. Cleveland was savagely criticized for trying to stem the new manifest destiny, and a popular jingle ran, "Liliuokalani, give us your brown, a little brown honey." But Cleveland's motives in the day of international land grabbing was honorable both to himself and to his country. The Hawaiian pear continued to ripen for five more years. Cubans rise in revolt. Cuba's masses, frightfully misgoverned, again rose against their Spanish oppressor in 1895. The roots of their revolt were partly economic, with partial origins in the United States. Sugar production, the backbone of the island's prosperity, was crippled when the American tariff of 1894 restored high duties on the toothsome product. Driven to desperation, the insurgents now adopted a scorched earth policy. They reasoned that if they did enough damage, Spain might be willing to move out, or the United States might move in and help the Cubans win their independence. In pursuance of this destructive strategy, the insurrectos torched cane fields and sugar mills. They even dynamited passenger trains. American sympathies, ever on the side of patriots fighting for freedom, went out to the Cuban underdogs. Aside from the pure sentiment, the United States had invested a stake about $50 million in Cuba and an annual trade stake of about $100 million. Moreover, Spanish misrule in Cuba menaced the shipping routes of the West Indies and the Gulf of Mexico and left directly the future Isthmian Canal. Fuel was added to the Cuban conflagration in 1896 with the coming of the Spanish general Butcher Weyler. He undertook to crush the rebellion by herding many civilians into barbed wire reconcentration camps where they could not give assistance to the armed insurrectos. Lacking proper sanitation, these enclosures turned into deadly pest holes. The victims died like dogs. An outraged American public demanded action. Congress in 1896 overwhelmingly passed a resolution that called upon President Cleveland to recognize the belligerency of the revolted Cubans. But as the government of the insurgents consisted of hardly more than a few fugitive leaders, Cleveland, an anti-jingoist and anti-imperialist, refused to budge. He defiantly vowed that if Congress declared war, the commander-in-chief would not issue the necessary order to mobilize the army. The mystery of the Maine explosion. Atrocities in Cuba were made to order for sensational new yellow journalism. William R. Hearst and Joseph Pulitzer, then engaged in a titanic duel for circulation, attempted to outdo each other with screeching headlines and hair-raising scoops. Lesser competitors zestfully followed suit. Where atrocity stories did not exist, they were invented. Hearst sent the gifted artist Frederick Remington to Cuba to draw sketches, and when the latter reported that conditions were not bad enough to warrant hostilities, Hearst is alleged to have replied, "You furnish the pictures, and I'll furnish the war." Among other outrages, Remington depicted Spanish customs officials brutally disrobing and searching an American woman. Most readers of Hearst's journal, their indignation soaring, had no way of knowing that such tasks were performed by female attendants. Butcher Weyler was removed in 1897, yet conditions steadily worsened. There was some talk in Spain of granting the rest of the island a type of self-government, but such a surrender was so bitterly opposed by many Spaniards in Cuba that they engaged in furious riots. Early in 1898, Washington sent the battleship Maine to Cuba, ostensibly for a friendly visit, but actually to protect and evacuate Americans if a dangerous flare-up should again occur. This already explosive situation suddenly grew acute on February 9, 1898, when Hearst sensationally headlined a private letter written by the Spanish minister in Washington, Dupuy de Lome. The indiscreet epistle, which had been stolen from the mails, described President McKinley as an ear-to-the-ground politician who lacked good faith. The resulting uproar was so violent that Dupuy de Lome was forced to resign. A tragic climax came a few days later, on February 15, 1898, when the Maine mysteriously blew up in Havana Harbor with a loss of 260 officers and men. Two investigators of the Iron Coffin were undertaken. Investigations were taken, one by U.S. naval officers and the other by Spanish officials, whom the Americans would not trust near the wreck. The Spanish commission stated that the explosion had been an internal and presumably accidental. The American commission reported that the blast had been caused by a submarine mine. Washington, not unmindful of popular indignation, spurred the Spanish proposals of arbitration. Various theories have been advanced as to how the Maine was blown up. The least convincing explanation of all is that the Spanish officials in Cuba were guilty, for they were under the American gun and Spain was far away. Not until 1976 did Admiral H.G. Rickover, under U.S. Navy auspices, give what appears to be the final answer. He presented overwhelming evidence that the initial explosion had resulted from a spontaneous combustion in one of the coal bunkers adjacent to a powder magazine. Ironically, this is essentially what the Spanish Commission had deduced in 1898. But Americans in 1898, now war mad, blindly accepted the least likely explanation. Lashed to fury by the yellow press, they leapt to the conclusion that the Spanish government had been guilty of intolerable treachery. The battle cry of the hour became, "Remember the Maine, to hell with Spain." Nothing would do but to hurl the dirty Spanish flag from the hemisphere. So a quick shortcut to remember why the war started. It basically was started because of the letter that the Spanish minister had wrote insulting our president, and because of the Maine blew up and we blamed him on it. So the war was started with a boat and a note. McKinley unleashes the dogs of war. The national fever for war burned higher, even though American diplomats had already gained Madrid's agreement to Washington's two basic demands, an end to the reconcentration camps and an armistice with Cuban rebels. The cautious McKinley did not want hostilities. The hesitant chief executive was condemned by jingoes as Wobbly Willie McKinley, while fight-hungry Theodore Roosevelt reportedly snarled that the white-livered occupant of the White House did not have the backbone of a chocolate eclair. The president, whose shaken nerves required sleeping pills, was even being hanged in effigy. Many critics did not realize that backbones needed to stay out of the war, not to plunge into it. McKinley's private desires clashed sharply with opinions now popular with the public. He did not want hostilities, for he had seen enough bloodshed as a major in the Civil War. Mark Hanna and Wall Street did not want war, for business might be unsettled. But the public, prodded by the yellow press and the appeals of Cuban exiles in the United States, clamored for a fight. The president, recognizing the inevitable, finally yielded and gave the people what they wanted. But the public pressures did not fully explain McKinley's course. He had no faith in Spain's promises regarding Cuba. Madrid had spoken them and broken them before. He was certain that a showdown would have to come sooner or later. He believed in the democratic principle that the people should rule, and he hesitated to deny Americans what they demanded, even if it was not good for them. He also perceived that if he stood out against the war, the Democrats would make political capital out of his stubbornness. Bryan might sweep into the presidency 2 years later under a banner inscribed Free Cuba and Free Silver. Gold Standard McKinley was a staunch party man, and to him it seemed better to break up the remnants of Spain's once glorious empire than to break up the grand old party, especially since war seemed inevitable. On April 11, 1898, McKinley sent his war message to Congress, urging armed intervention to free the oppressed Cubans. The legislators responded uproariously with what was essentially a declaration of war. In a burst of self-righteousness, they likewise adopted the hand-tying Teller Amendment. This proviso proclaimed to the world that when the United States had overthrown Spanish misrule, it would give Cubans their freedom, and declaration that caused imperialist Europeans to smile skeptically, like, yeah, right. So, again, the Teller Amendment, no, the Teller Amendment. We said yes to war with Spain, we're going to take going to Cuba, kick them out. But the Teller Amendment said that we will give Cuba to the Cubans, and the Europeans' reaction was like, we'll see if that happens. Dewey's Day, May Day victory at Manila. The American people plunged into the war lightheartedly, like schoolchildren off to a picnic. Bands blared incessantly, "There'll be a hot time in the old town tonight," and "Hail, hail, all the gangs here," thus leading foreigners to believe that those were the national anthems. But such jubilation seemed premature to European observers. The regular army, which was commanded by corpulent Civil War oldsters, was unprepared for a war under tropical skies. It numbered only 2,100 officers and 28,000 men. as compared with some 200,000 Spanish troops in Cuba. The American Navy, at least to the transatlantic experts, seemed slightly less powerful than Spain's. European powers, moreover, were generally friendly to their old world associate. The only conspicuous exception was the ally-seeking British, who now were ardently wooing their American cousins. Yet in one important respect, Spain's apparent superiority was illusory. Its navy, though formidable on paper, was in wretched condition. It labored under the added handicap of having to operate thousands of miles from its home base. But the new American steel navy, now 15 years old and ranking about fifth among the fleets of the world, was in fairly good trim, though the war was to lay bare some serious defects. The readiness of the navy owed much to do the two men, the easygoing Navy Secretary John D. Long and his bellicose Assistant Secretary Theodore Roosevelt. The secretary hardly dared to leave his desk for fear that his overzealous underling would stir up a hot hornet's nest. On February 25, 1898, while Long was away for a weekend, Roosevelt had cabled Commodore George Dewey, commanding the American Asiatic Squadron at Hong Kong, to descend upon Spain's Philippines in the event of a war. McKinley subsequently confirmed these instructions, even though an attack on a distant Far East seemed like a strange way to free nearby Cuba. Dewey carried out his orders magnificently on May 1, 1898, sailing boldly with his six warships at night into the fortified harbor at Manila. He trained his guns the next morning on the 10-ship Spanish fleet, one of whose craft was only a moored hulk without functioning engines. The entire collection of antiquated and overmatched vessels was quickly destroyed, with the loss of nearly 400 Spaniards killed and wounded, and without the loss of a single life in Dewey's fleet. An American consul who was there wrote that all the American sailors needed were cough drops for throat made raw by cheers of victory. Unexpected imperialist plumes. Taciturn George Dewey became a national hero overnight. He was promptly promoted to the rank of admiral, as the price of flags rose sharply. An amateur poet blossomed forth with this: "Oh, Dewey was the morning upon the 1st of May, and Dewey was the admiral down in Manila Bay. And Dewey were the Spaniards' eyes, them orbs of black and blue, and do we feel this courage? I do not think we do." Dr. Seuss would be envious. Yet Dewey was in a perilous position. He had destroyed the enemy fleet, but he could not storm the forts of Manila with his sailors. His nerves frayed, he was forced to wait in a steaming hot bay while troop reinforcements were slowly assembled in America. Foreign warships, meanwhile, had begun to gather in the harbor, ostensibly to safeguard their nationals in Manila. The Germans sent five vessels, a navy force more powerful than Dewey's, and their haughty admiral defied the American blockade regulations. After several disagreeable incidents, Dewey lost his temper and threatened the arrogant German with war as soon as you like. Happily, the storm blew over. The British commander, by contrast, was conspicuously successful in carrying out London's new policy of friendliness. A false tale subsequently circulated that the British dramatically interposed their ships to prevent the Germans from blowing the Americans out of the water. Long-awaited American troops, finally arriving in force, captured Manila on August 13, 1898. They collaborated with the Filipino insurgents, commanded by their well-educated, part-Chinese leader, Emiliano Aguinaldo. Dewey, to his later regret, had brought this shrewd and magnetic revolutionary from the exile in Asia so that he might weaken Spanish resistance. These thrilling events in the Philippines had meanwhile focused attention on Hawaii. An impression spread that America needed the archipelago, Hawaii, as a coaling and provisioning way station in order to send supplies and reinforcements to Dewey. The truth is that the United States could have used these island crossroads of the Pacific without annexing them. So eager was the white-dominated Honolulu government to compromise its neutrality and risk the vengeance of Spain. But an appreciative American public would not leave Dewey in the lurch. A joint resolution of annexation was rushed through Congress and approved by McKinley on July 7, 1898. The residents of Hawaii were granted U.S. citizenship with annexation and received full territorial status in 1900. These events in the idyllic islands, though seemingly sudden, were but the culmination of nearly a century of Americanization by sailors, whalers, traders, and missionaries. The confused invasion of Cuba. Shortly after the outbreak of war, the Spanish government ordered a fleet of warships to Cuba. It was commanded by Admiral Cervera, who protested that his wretchedly prepared ships were flirting with suicide. Four armored cruisers finally set forth, one without its main battery of guns. They were accompanied by six torpedoed boats, three of which had to be abandoned en route. Panic seized the eastern seaboard of the United States. American vacationers abandoned their seaside cottages, while nervous investors moved their securities to inland depositories. Demands for protection poured in on Washington from nervous citizens, and the Navy Department was forced to dispatch some useless old Civil War ships to useless places for morale purposes. Cervera finally found refuge in the bottle-shaped Santiago Harbor in Cuba, where he was blockaded by the much more powerful American fleet. Sound strategy seemed to dictate that an American army be sent in from the rear to drive out Cervera. Landing the invading force was the grossly overweight General William Shafter, a leader so blubbery and gout-stricken that he had to be carried about on a door. The ill-prepared Americans were unequipped for war in the tropics. They had been amply provided with heavy wool underwear and uniforms designed for sub-zero operations against the Indians. The Rough Riders, a part of the invading army, now charged onto the stage of history. This colorful regiment of volunteers, short on discipline but long on dash, consisted largely of Western cowboys and other hardy characters, with a sprinkling of ex-polo players and ex-convicts. Commanded by Colonel Leonard Wood, the group was organized principally by the glory-hungry Theodore Roosevelt, who had resigned from the Navy Department to serve as lieutenant colonel. Although totally without military experience, he used his strong political pull to secure his commission and to bypass physical standards. He was so nearsighted that as a safeguard, he took along a dozen pairs of spectacles, cached in handy spots on his person or nearby. About the middle of June, a bewildered American army of 17,000 men finally embarked at congested Tampa, Florida, amid scenes of indiscernible confusion. The Rough Riders, fearing that they would be robbed of glory, rushed on one of the transports and courageously, held their place for almost a week in the broiling tropical sun. About half of them finally got to Cuba without most of their horses, and the bow-legged regiment then came to be known as Wood's Weary Walkers. Shafter's landing near Santiago, Cuba, was made without serious opposition. Defending Spaniards, even more disorganized than Americans, were unable to muster at this spot more than 2,000 men. Brisk fighting broke out on July 1st at El Cane and San Juan Hill, up which Colonel Roosevelt and his horseless Rough Riders charged with strong support from two crack black regiments. They suffered heavy casualties, but the colorful colonel, having the time of his life, shot a Spaniard with his revolver and rejoiced to see his victim doubled up like a jackrabbit. He later wrote a book on the exploits, which the famed satirist Mr. Dooley remarked ought to have been entitled Alone in Cuba. Curtains for Spain in America. The American army, fast closing in on Santiago, spelled doom for the Spanish fleet. Admiral Cervera, again protesting against suicide, was flatly ordered to fight for the honor of the flag. The odds against him were heavy. The guns of the USS Oregon alone, foul-bottomed Spanish fleet, destroyed. Hold on a minute. Let me go back to that real quick. I missed the page. The guns of the USS Oregon alone threw more metal than its four armored cruisers combined. After running a chase on July 3rd, the foul-bottomed Spanish fleet was entirely destroyed, as the wooden decks caught fire and the blazing infernos were beached. About 500 Spaniards were killed, as compared with one death for the Americans. "Don't cheer, men," admonished Captain Philip of the Texas. "The poor devils are dying." Shortly thereafter, Santiago surrendered. Hasty preparations were now made for a descent upon Puerto Rico before the war should end. The American army, commanded by the famed Indian fighter General Nelson Miles, met little resistance, as most of the population greeted the invaders as liberating heroes. Mr. Dooley was led to refer to General Miles' grand picnic and moonlight excursion. By this time, Spain had satisfied its honor, and on August 12, 1898, it signed an armistice. If the Spaniards had held out only a few months longer in Cuba, the American army might have melted away. The inroads of malaria, typhoid, dysentery, and yellow fever became so severe that hundreds were incapacitated, an army of convalescents. Others suffered from odorous canned meat known as embalmed beef. Fiery and insubordinate Colonel Roosevelt, who had no regular military career to jeopardize, was a ringleader in making round-robin demands on Washington that the army be moved before it perished. About 25,000 men, 80% of them ill, were transferred to chilly Long Island, where their light summer clothing finally arrived. One of the war's most worst scandals was the high death rate from sickness, especially from typhoid fever. This disease was rampant in the unsanitary training camps in the United States. All told, nearly 400 men lost their lives to bullets. Over 5,000 succumbed to bacteria and other causes. So, quick pause. America, going to war with Spain, has taken over three of Spain's colonies, the Philippines in Asia and Puerto Rico and Cuba in the Caribbean. McKinley heeds duty, destiny, and dollars. Late in 1898, the Spanish and American negotiators met in Paris, there to begin heated discussions. McKinley had sent five commissioners, including three senators, who had had the final vote on their own handiwork. War-racked Cuba, as expected, was freed from its Spanish overlords. The Americans had little difficulty in securing the remote Pacific island of Guam, which they had captured early in the conflict from astonished Spaniards who, lacking a cable, had not known the war was going on. They also picked up Puerto Rico, the last remnant of what had been Spain's vast New World Empire. In the decades to come, American investment in the island and Puerto Rican immigration to the United States would make this acquisition one of the weightier consequences of the somewhat carefree war. Naughtiest of all was the problem of the Philippines, a veritable apple of discord. These lush islands not only embrace an area larger than the British Isles, but also contained a completely alien population of some 7 million souls. McKinley was confronted with a devil's dilemma. He did not feel that America could honorably give the islands back to Spanish misrule, especially after it fought a war to free Cuba. And America would be turning its back upon its responsibilities in a cowardly fashion, he believed, if he simply pulled up anchor and sailed away. McKinley viewed other alternatives open to him as trouble fraught. The Filipinos, if left to govern themselves, might fall into anarchy. One of the major powers, possibly aggressive Germany, might then try to seize them, and the result might be a world war in which the United States would be sucked. Seemingly, the least of the evils consistent with national honor and safety was to acquire all the Philippines, and then perhaps give Filipinos their freedom later. President McKinley, ever sensitive to public opinion, kept a carefully attuned ear to the ground. The rumble that he heard seemed to call for the entire group of islands. Zealous Protestant missionaries were eager for the new converts from Spanish Catholicism, and the invalid Mrs. McKinley, to whom her husband was devoted, expressed deep concern about the welfare of the Filipinos. Wall Street had generally opposed the war, but awakened the booming of Dewey's gun. It was clamoring for profits in the Philippines. If this be commercialism, crawled Mark Hanna, then for God's sake, let's have commercialism. A tormented McKinley, so he was later reported as saying, finally went down on his knees seeking divine guidance. An inner voice seemed to tell him to take all the Philippines and Christianize and civilize them. This solution apparently coincided with the demands of the American people, as well with the McKinley-Hanna outlook. The mixture of things spiritual and material in McKinley's reasoning was later slyly summarized by an historian. God directs us, perhaps it will pay. Prophets thus joined hands with piety. Fresh disputes broke out with the Spanish negotiators in Paris. Once McKinley had reached the thorny decision to keep the Philippines, Manila had been captured the day after the armistice was signed, and the islands could not properly be listed among the spoils of war. The deadlock was broken when Americans at length agreed to pay Spain $20 million for the Philippine Islands, one of the best bargains the Spaniards ever drove, and their last great haul from the New World. House Speaker Czar Reed sneered at America's having acquired millions of Malays at $3 a head in the bush. He resigned in protest against America's new imperial adventure. America's course, or curse, of empire. The signing of the Pact of Paris touched off one of the most impassioned debates in American history. Except for glacial Alaska, coral reefed Hawaii, and a handful of Pacific atolls acquired mostly for whaling stations, the Republic had hitherto acquired only contiguous territory on the continent. All previous acquisitions had been thinly peopled and capable of ultimate statehood. But in the Philippines, the nation had on its hands a distant tropical area. Thickly populated by Asians of alien race, culture, tongue, religion, and government institutions. The Anti-Imperialist League sprang into being to fight the McKinley administration's expansionist moves. The organization counted among its members some of the most prominent people in the United States, including the presidents of Stanford and Harvard universities, the philosopher William James, and the novelist Mark Twain. The Anti-Imperialist blanket even stretched over such strange bedfellows as labor leader Samuel Gompers and steel titan Andrew Carnegie. God damn the United States for its vile conduct in the Philippine Isles, burst out the usually mild-mannered Professor James. The Harvard philosopher could not believe that the United States could puke up its ancient soul in 5 minutes without a wink of squeamishness. Anti-imperialists had also still other arrows in their quiver. The Filipinos panted for freedom, and to annex them would violate the consent of the governed philosophy of the Declaration of Independence. Despotism abroad might well beget despotism at home. And finally, annexation would propel the United States into the political and military cauldron of the Far East. Yet the expansionists or imperialists could sing a seductive song. They appealed to patriotism, to the glory of annexation. Don't let any dastard dishonor the flag by hauling it down. Distressing the opportunities for exploiting the islands, they played up the possible trade profits. Manila, in fact, might become another Hong Kong. The richer the natural resources of the islands appeared to be, the less capable of self-government the Filipinos seemed to be. Rudyard Kipling, the British poet laureate of imperialism, urged America down the slippery path. He said, "Take up the white man's burden. Ye dare not stoop to less, nor call too loud on freedom to cloak your weariness." In short, the wealthy Americans must help uplift and exploit the underprivileged, underfed, and underclad of the world. In the Senate, the Spanish treaty ran into such heated opposition that it seemed doomed to defeat. But at this juncture, the Silverite Bryan unexpectedly sallied forth as its champion. As a Democratic volunteer colonel, whom the Republicans had kept out of Cuba, he apparently had no reason to help the McKinley administration out of a hole. but free silver was dead as a political issue. Bryan's foes assumed that he was preparing to fasten the stigma of imperialism on Republicans and then sweep into the presidency in 1900 under the flag of flaming banner of anti-imperialism. Bryan could support the treaty on plausible grounds. He argued that the war would not officially end until America had ratified the pact. It already had the islands on its hands, and the sooner it accepted the document, the sooner it could give the Filipinos their independence. After Bryan had issued his personal influence with certain Democratic senators, the treaty was approved on February 6, 1899, with only one vote to spare. But the responsibility, as Bryan had foreseen, rested primarily with the Republicans. Perplexities in Puerto Rico and Cuba. So we've dealt with Philippines. We're gonna take the Philippines. We're going to stay there for a while, maybe give them their independence later on. Now for Puerto Rico and Cuba. Many of Puerto Rico's 1 million inhabitants lived in poverty. The island's population grew faster than its economy. The Foraker Act of 1900, Congress accorded the Puerto Ricans a limited degree of popular government, and in 1917 granted them U.S. citizenship. Although the American regime worked wonders in education, sanitation, transportation, and other tangible improvements, many of the inhabitants still aspired to independence. Great numbers of Puerto Ricans ultimately moved to New York City, where they added to the diversity of its immigrant culture. A thorny legal problem was posed by the questions, did the Constitution follow the flag? Did American laws, including tariff laws and the Bill of Rights, apply with full force to the newly acquired possessions? Beginning in 1901 with the Insular Cases, a badly divided Supreme Court decreed, in effect, that the flag did outrun the Constitution, and that the outdistance document did not necessarily extend with full force to the new windfalls. The Filipinos and Puerto Ricans might be subject to American rule, but they did not enjoy all American rights. Cuba, scorched and chaotic, presented another headache. An American military government, set up under the administrative genius of General Leonard Wood, of Rough Rider fame, wrought miracles in government, finance, education, agriculture, and public health. Under his leadership, a frontal attack was launched on yellow fever. Spectacular experiments were performed by Dr. Walter Reed and others upon American soldiers who volunteered as human guinea pigs, and the Stegomyia mosquito was proved to be the lethal carrier. A cleanup of breeding places for mosquitoes wiped out yellow fever in Havana, while removing the recurrent fear of epidemics in cities of the South and Atlantic seaboard. The United States, honoring its self-denying Teller Amendment of 1898, withdrew from Cuba in 1902. Old-world imperialists could scarcely believe their eyes, but the Washington government could not turn this rich and strategic island completely loose on the international sea. A grasping power like Germany might secure dangerous lodgment near the American soft underbelly. The Cubans were therefore forced to write into their own constitution of 1901 the so-called Platt Amendment. The Platt Amendment, known that, please. The hated restrictions severely hobbled the Cubans. They reluctantly bound themselves not to impair their independence by treaty or by contract, contracting a debt beyond their resources. They further agreed that the U.S. might intervene with troops to restore order and to provide mutual protection. Finally, the Cubans promised to sell or lease needed coaling and naval stations, ultimately two and then only one, Guantanamo, to their powerful benefactor. The United States still occupies its 28,000-acre beachhead under an agreement that can be revoked only by consent of both parties. So the Teller Amendment was this amendment that said, hey, we're not going to make this a colony, back in 1898. After the war, we were going to pull out of Cuba, but we forced them to sign this Platt Amendment, which basically hobbled their independence, saying that we could restore order with our troops whenever we saw fit, and that they're going to kind of behave themselves, which is very patronizing. New horizons in two hemispheres. In essence, the Spanish-American War was a kind of colossal coming-out party. Despite a common misconception, the conflict did not cause the United States to become a world power. Dewey's thundering guns merely advertised the fact that the nation was already a world power. We're going to skip the makers of America. The war itself was short, 113 days. Spectacular, low in casualties, and uninterruptedly successful, despite the bulging American prestige rose sharply, and the European powers grudgingly accorded the Republic more respect. In Germany, Prince Bismarck reportedly growled that there was a special providence that looked after drunkards, fools, and the United States of America. At times, it seemed that though not only providence, but the Spaniards were fighting on the sides of the Yankees. So great, in fact, was America's good fortune that the rejoicing citizens found in their victories further support, misleading support, for their indifference to adequate preparedness. An exhilarating new spirit thrilled America, buoyed along by the new popular military marching band music of John Philip Sousa. National pride was touched, and cockiness was increased by what John Hay called the splendid little war. Enthusiasm over these triumphs made easy the rush down the thorny path of empire. America did not start the war with imperialistic motives, but after falling through the cellar door of imperialism in a drunken fit of idealism, it wound up with imperialistic and colonial fruits in its grasp. The much-criticized British imperialists were pleased, partly because of the newfound friendship, partly because misery loves company. But America's German rival was envious, and Latin American neighbors were deeply suspicious of Yankee greed. By taking on the Philippine Islands, the United States became a full-fledged Far Eastern power. Hereafter, these distant islands were to be a heel of Achilles, a kind of indefensible hostage given to Japan, as events proved in 1941. With singular short-sightedness, the Americans assumed dangerous commitments that they were later unwilling to defend by proper naval and military outlays. But the lessons of unpreparedness were not altogether lost. Captain Mahan's big navyism seemed vindicated, and pride in the exploits of the Navy energized popular support for more and better battleships. A masterly organizer, Elihu Root, took over the reins of the War Department. He established a general staff and founded a war college in Washington. His genius later paid dividends when the United States found itself involved in the World War of 1914 and 1918. One of the happiest results of the conflict was the further closing of the bloody chasm between the North and the South. Thousands of patriotic Southerners had flocked to the Stars and Stripes, and the gray-bearded General Joseph Wheeler, a Confederate cavalry hero of about 1,000 Civil War skirmishes and battles, was given a command in Cuba. He allegedly cried in the heat of battle, "To hell with the Yankees! Damn it, I mean the Spaniards." I'd like to thank our special guest and audience here, Casey, Aiden, Brenna, and Jade. Goodbye.